Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 39, which I will entitle Prophecy Against Gog, Part B. Gog is our concern in Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. I've had to break it up a little bit. I have decided that Gog was Haman in the book of Esther. This is a position which is well reasoned in the first audio I did on Gog. On Ezekiel chapter 38, verses 1 through 3, I spent an hour talking about Gog and how Gog is identified with Haman, so I can't go over that again. I would refer you to that if you would like an in-depth defense of the position that Gog was Haman. So I'm going to assume Haman as I go through this chapter. This prophecy was given, I'm assuming, at the same time as the prophecy was given in 38 against Gog, chapter 38 of Ezekiel. And that date was 585/584, somewhere around there, a couple of years right after the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians in 586. So we begin now in verses 1 through 6 of Ezekiel 39. Son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. I will turn you around and drag you along. I will bring you from the far north and send you against the mountains of Israel. Then I will strike your bow from your left hand and make your arrows drop from your right hand. On the mountains of Israel you will fall, you and all your troops and the nations with you. I will give you as food to all kinds of carrion birds and to the wild animals. You will fall in the open field, for I have spoken, declares the sovereign Lord. I will send fire on Magog and on those who live in safety in the coastlands, and they will know that I am the Lord. Now in verse 1, Yahweh addresses Ezekiel as son of man, as I've said about 1,000 times earlier as we've gone through Ezekiel. That is the standard address that God gave Ezekiel. Maybe he wants to keep him humble. That's one theory. Son of man, you're just a man. Men are fallible and weak. And even though I'm giving you all these prophecies, that doesn't mean that you're not still just a man. I don't think so. I think God is trying to make a type out of Ezekiel, because the antitype of Ezekiel is Jesus, who called himself the Son of Man all the way through the Gospels, taking that title from Daniel 7:14, the Son of Man ascended up to the Ancient of Days. It was a messianic title, understood to be that in the Old Testament, so Jesus appropriated it, and he is the Son of Man. The antitype of Ezekiel, who was also a son of man, because Ezekiel was prophesying against the rebellious house of Israel and predicted the destruction of their temple in 586 BC, whereas Jesus also prophesied against the rebellious house of Israel and prophesied the destruction of Israel's temple in AD 70. Now, this prophecy against Gog in verses 1 and the rest of the chapter, actually, but verse 1 is repeated from Ezekiel 38, verses 1 and 2. Ezekiel 38, 1 and 2 says, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, turn your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, prophesy against him. Magog is the land of Gog. It's not a particular place. Why did God repeat it? Probably to confirm the prophecy, to inject terror into Ezekiel, as John Gill claims, but for whatever reason, he repeated it. And he says, this is what the sovereign Lord says. God is sovereign over history. He can raise up nations and exalt them, and he can destroy them. And since Ezekiel is prophesying about nations here, that makes sense. Yahweh says to Ezekiel, I'm against you, O Gog, and I'm assuming that's Haman, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. That's chief prince, not prince of Rosh, as the futurist prophecy enthusiast like to all the time say, Rosh is Russia. No, it's not. It's chief priest. Haman was the prime minister of Persia. He was the chief prince. He was the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Meshach is in the center of Anatolia, present-day Turkey. Tubal is at the northern coast of present-day Turkey on the southern edge of the Black Sea. I'm assuming these places are mentioned because Haman was actually chief prince over all of Persia. But the northern regions are mentioned because from the north is where the enemies of Israel always come from. And as we see here, we're going to see a great battle, but there was no great battle against Haman. If you recall the story from Esther, Ahasuerus, the king, reversed Haman's edict against the Jews, in which all the citizens of the Persian Empire were going to have free reign to kill the Jews. And Ahasuerus says, no, we're going to let the Jews kill the Persians. And so there was a great slaughter. And all of this, in my humble opinion, is figurative language. All this battle imagery is figurative imagery of the slaughter of the Persians. After all, in Esther, 75,310 Persians went down. And Meshach and Tubal are in the north. If you look at Israel compared to Meshach and Tubal, Israel is south of Meshach and Tubal. The enemies of Israel come from the north. And so Ezekiel is using that same formulation. The enemies of Israel come from the north. If you recall, as we've gone through Jeremiah and Isaiah, constantly Babylon is said to be coming from the north. They have to. Babylon, even though it was to the east of Israel, could not cross the Arabian desert to go due west, so Babylon had to go north up the Mesopotamian Valley, cross the Euphrates River in Syria, and then come on down to the south to get to Israel. Babylon could not come from the south, of course. There's nothing but desert down there, Arabia Petraea, shielding Israel, and the west of Israel is the Mediterranean Sea, so that was the only place that the enemies of Israel could come from the north. And so that's why it says in verse 2, I will bring you from the far north. Gog, Haman, you're going to come against Israel. But then God says in verse 3, I will strike your bow from your left hand and make your arrows drop from your right hand. In other words, you're not going to be able to carry out your military vengeance on Israel. Again, Haman had a decree of the king that all the Persians would be allowed to kill all the Jews. That was his power. And this is symbolic. Your bow will be struck from your left hand, your arrows drop. You're not going to have any power over the Jews anymore. Verse 4, on the mountains of Israel you will fall, you and all your troops and the nations with you. Now, this is one objection that people have to the Haman hypothesis. Haman didn't fall on the mountains of Israel. No, but the mountains of Israel is a symbol of all the Jews. And besides, we're going to have several verses scattered through Ezekiel 38 and 39, which shows that the slaughter happened elsewhere besides Israel. For example, in verse 6, which I just read, I will send fire on Magog and on those who live in safety in the coastlands. That would be all through the Persian Empire, the coastlands. That could be put in Libya on the southern coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And I'm not sure how far the Persian Empire extended back then, but obviously coastlands is not just Israel. So I'm not worried about the objection that this slaughter is happening in the land of Israel. Now in verse 4, Yahweh says that, Gog, I'm going to give you as food to all kinds of carrion birds and to the wild animals. A carrion bird is a bird that feasts on dead flesh. We have them here in South Carolina, turkey buzzards. They fly all over the rural roads of South Carolina eating the dead possums. If they ever hit your car, may God help you. They're tremendous. They look like nasty vultures. And they also look like turkeys. That's why they call them turkey buzzards. And when they fly, they can fly, but they take a long time to get off the ground. I saw one time when I was a little boy running down a hill on a street in my hometown, and it took him a while to get off the ground. It looked like a 749 jetliner. And that thing finally got off the ground, and it scared the ever-loving blazes out of me. It's one of my childhood memories. So to get eaten up by one of these things is very unpleasant. Now you might think, well, the person is dead. What does he care what happens to his corpse? Well, that's not the way people thought back then. It was always reckoned a very, very severe judgment and a dreadful calamity not to have a burial. And to be left out on the ground to be exposed to birds and beasts of prey was awful. In fact, this was a curse mentioned in the curses in Deuteronomy 28. We read in verse 26, your corpses will be food for all the birds of the sky and the wild animals of the land, with no one to scare them away, assuming disobedience on the part of the Jews. Jeremiah, in a verse, unfortunately, which I don't have, he promised to the wicked Jews that they were going to get eaten up without burial. And in Jeremiah 16:4, he makes that promise explicitly to one of the evil kings, Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim ruled from 609 to 598. Jeremiah 16:4, they, referring to the people of Judah, will die from deadly diseases. They will not be mourned or buried, but will be like manure on the face of the earth. They will be finished off by sword and famine. Their corpses will become food for the birds of the sky and for the wild animals of the land. So getting your body eaten up by a vulture or some other kind of bird or beast was lamented by the Jews as one of the greatest evils that could befall good men. We read in Psalm 79:2, They gave the corpses of your servants to the birds of the sky for food, the flesh of your godly ones to the beast of the earth. Dropping down to verse 6, Yahweh says he will send fire on Magog. Fire, of course, is a symbol of destruction. Magog is the land of Gog. And if Gog is Haman, the land of Gog will be all through the Persian Empire. By the way, the date of that, Haman's destruction was somewhere in the 470s, assuming that the king Ahasuerus was Xerxes. I realize that many proponents of the Haman hypothesis, such as James Jordan, James Jordan does, he says that Ahasuerus is Darius, but I'm going to assume Xerxes because I haven't studied that proposition of James Jordan, and so we'll put Haman somewhere in the 470s. Fire is going to come on the Persians, who previously had the right, the legal right to assault Jews. They lived in safety in the coastlands all through the Persian Empire until Ahasuerus issued his second decree, which says now the Jews can kill the Persians. Now, a few minor comments before I move on. In verse 2, God tells Gog, I will turn you around. The older translations, such as the KJV, have a unique translation. None of the other translations have it. And that translation is this, and I will turn you back and leave but the sixth part of thee. Well, what does that mean? One option, it could mean that 1/6 of the army of Gog was not destroyed, but that's hard to believe. In this extended metaphor, the whole army was destroyed. Another option is 1/6 of Gog's army was left at home. I think that's highly problematical. A marginal reading, a marginal translation in the King James has, God will strike thee with 6 plagues, or draw thee back with a hook of 6 teeth. Well, that's getting out there. None of the other translations have this, so we're not going to worry about it. Let me mention in verse 3, where God says he will strike the bow from Gog's left hand. Adam Clark says, the Persians whom Antiochus had in his army, that's Antiochus Epiphanes, he's about 165 or so, were famous as archers, and they may be intended here. There was an older theory that Gog was Antiochus Epiphanes. A lot of the older commentators had it. In fact, James Jordan, who, as far as I know, came up with a Haman hypothesis, he used to think that Antiochus Epiphanes was Gog, but he changed his mind. But I just mentioned that just for the sake of completeness. And so now we move to Ezekiel 39, verses 7 through 8. Yahweh continues speaking to Gog. I will make known my holy name among my people Israel. I will no longer let my holy name be profaned, and the nations will know that I, the Lord, am the Holy One in Israel. It is coming. It will surely take place, declares the Sovereign Lord. This is the day I have spoken of. Spoken of when? When has God spoken against Gog before? Well, this is a problem because nowhere in the Old Testament has Gog ever been spoken of before, whoever Gog is. Now, I covered this problem when I was covering Ezekiel 38:17, which read this way. This is what the Lord God says. Are you the one I spoke about in former times through my servants? Are you Gog, the one I spoke about in former times through my servants, the prophets of Israel, who for years prophesied in those times that I would bring you against them? For years, earlier prophets have been prophesying against Gog, and we don't have one mention of it? That is a huge problem. Well, let me read you some weak attempts to solve the problem. This is from John Gill. Well, maybe Gog was just prophesied against under a different name. Maybe Isaiah prophesied against Gog when he prophesied against Leviathan. Maybe Micah prophesied against Gog when Micah prophesied against the Assyrians. Or maybe Daniel prophesied against Gog when he prophesied against Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, that's total speculation. Now, this previous prophecies against Gog is an argument for the Antiochus Epiphanes theory, because Antiochus Epiphanes was prophesied against before this prophecy in Ezekiel, in Daniel, for example, but Haman was not. Well, here's the answer according to the Haman hypothesis. Ezekiel was prophesying about Gog because Gog is the same as Agag. 2 G's in Gog, 2 G's, 2 Gimels, I should say, in Gog in the Hebrew, 2 Gimels in Agag. The vowels, of course, or added later, different vowels could be because of different pronunciations in Persia and in Israel. To show how Gog is the same as Agag, we can take a verse in Numbers, chapter 24, verse 7, where Agag is used. Look at the Septuagint translation of that verse, and we'll see that Gog is used. Numbers 24, 7, water shall flow from Israel's buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. His king shall be higher than Agag. Numbers 24, 7 in the Septuagint. There shall come a man out of Israel's seeds, and he shall rule over many nations. The kingdom of Gog shall be exalted. Agag and Gog. That's pretty strong, if you ask me. Now, Agag is the Amalekite king. Remember, Saul didn't kill Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And so, if we're looking at the Amalekites, we have an interesting connection because the book of Esther explicitly says that Haman was the son of an Agagite. In other words, an Amalekite. So Haman was an Amalekite. Gog equals Haman equals Amalekite. And God prophesied against the Amalekites a whole bunch of times before. So that's why this verse here in Ezekiel 39, which says, this is the day against Gog that I have spoken of, he's referring to all the times he prophesied against the Amalekites. And this prophecy against Gog, who is Haman, is just a continuation of the prophecies that God has made in the past against the Amalekites, because Haman is an Amalekite. Haman is Gog. He's an Agagite. Gog is Agag, same thing. And God's been prophesying against the Amalekites for a long, long time, ever since Israel came out of Egypt. Remember that battle where, who was it, Joshua and Hur, I think it was, held up the arms of Moses so that the battle against the Amalekites could rage on victoriously? That was the Amalekites. Oh my gosh, Amalekites are all through the Old Testament. That's why God tells Gog here in Ezekiel 39, this is the day I have spoken of in the past. We go to Ezekiel 39, verses 9 through 10. God continues speaking to Gog. Then those who live in the towns of Israel will go out and use the weapons for fuel and burn them up, the small and large shields, the bows and arrows, the war clubs and spears. For 7 years they will use them for fuel. They will not need to gather wood from the fields or cut it from the forest, because they will use the weapons for fuel. And they will plunder those who plundered them, and loot those who looted them, declares the Sovereign Lord. Notice how in verse 10, they will plunder those who plundered them. Remember, the first edict said that the Persians could steal and rob and kill the Jews in the empire. But then the second edict from Ahasuerus says, no, now the Jews can plunder the ones who were coming after them. So that fits pretty good. Fits the Haman hypothesis pretty good. Now remember, all this warfare imagery is just that imagery, talking about the destruction of Haman and his Persians, who originally had the right to kill the Jews. Those who live in the towns of Israel, that means all the Israelites. The towns of Israel just represents all the Israelites in the Persian Empire. And so all of Gog's weapons would be burnt up. For 7 years, the Israelites would use them as fuel. Now, we don't want to take 7 years as literally 7 years. Seven is an obvious symbolic number. It's all through the Old Testament. It's the number of perfection and maturity, divine perfection. 7 days in the week, seven creation days, 7777 everywhere. And the idea is to say that if it takes 7 years to burn up the weapons, what an awful lot of weapons will go down. Now, I would like to point out, if this is referring to a future battle against Gog and Magog, as the prophecy enthusiast would like to tell us, especially those prophecy enthusiasts who tell us we must constantly take these matters as literal, are we to understand that the weapons that are going to be used in this future war are bows and arrows, mentioned in verse 9, clubs, spears? Oh, no, no. The bow and arrows, that's symbolic of a missile launcher and a missile. What happened to the literalism of the futurist dispensationalists who love to talk about this stuff and try to tell me there's going to be a big, huge battle that's being referred to here, and the Jews in Israel are literally going to make a bonfire that lasts 7 years? A bonfire of missile launchers and missiles? Please, this is symbolic. It's obviously symbolic. So in this figure of speech, 7 years it takes to burn all these war clubs, spears, and bows and arrows. That's a long time. So they don't need to gather wood from the forest. It says that the weapons are going to be used for fuel. That could be fuel for heating or fuel for food. Some people who like to get into the literalness of this say, well, it could just be fuel for cooking and not for heating, and therefore it's perfectly reasonable that weapons could last 7 years. No, it's symbolic. It just means a lot of Gog's enemies, Haman's enemies, went down to defeat. So let's look at this 7 years of burning weapons, how some people have interpreted it. One interpretation is that this 7 years is hyperbolic. In other words, it's just an extreme exaggeration. It was not literally 7 years. It was a lot of years, and seven was just used as hyperbole. I don't believe that. 7 years, I mean, that's a well-known symbolic number in the Old Testament. So the second option is that 7 years is symbolic. 7 years is a symbol of divinity, divine maturity or perfection. God's judgment is perfectly executed. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown say. The 7 years, seven being the sacred number, spent on this work, implies the completeness of the cleansing and the people's zeal for purity. Hear, hear, Jameson Fawcett and Brown. Those commentators wrote before the coming of Hal Lindsey and Tim LaHaye, who have screwed up Christians' thinking immensely. Here's what Adam Clark says. These may be figurative expressions after the manner of the Asiatics, whose language abounds with such descriptions. They occur everywhere in the prophets. As to the number seven, it is only a certain number for an indeterminate number. Well, I think there's your answer right there. Now let's look at what some people say who claimed that the 7 years is literal. Now this is good. This is from John Gill. He says, when it is considered, and by the way, John Gill was not a dispensationalist. He operated before that unfortunate theology came along, but he still takes it literally. He says, when it is considered what a vast army this of Gog's will be, and what prodigious numbers of weapons of all sorts must be carried by them, and the little use of fire in those hot countries, it may be very well taken in a literal sense. Gill's trying to deal with the problem is, how can an army have enough weapons to keep a country supplied in firewood for 7 years? Well, it's hot. You don't need a lot of fire. I just think, quite frankly, that's approaching silliness. Now, here's another suggestion as to how the 7 years of fire might be literal. This is from Adam Clark. And as all seem to have been doomed to the fire, there might have been some found at different intervals and burned during the 7 years here mentioned. In other words, the 7 years are not continuous. We burn a little bit for 1 year, wait another year, burn some more, don't burn any more for another year. I mean, really, please. I guess they're going to go without heat and fuel for the greater part of the years in order to conserve their fuel, to conserve their weapons, which are being used for fuel. Here's another way you can make it be literal. It has been suggested that perhaps the wooden weapons were just used for food, but not for heat. That would make the weapons last a lot longer because you don't have to heat yourself. Well, I think you can see that this number is symbolic. It's not literal. We move now to Ezekiel 39:11. God continues speaking to Gog. On that day I will give Gog a burial place in Israel, in the valley of those who travel east toward the sea. It will block the way of travelers, because Gog and all his hordes will be buried there. So it will be called the Valley of Haman Gog. Now this is a key verse. First of all, in this extended metaphor, what is this valley of those who travel east toward the sea? Well, let's take toward first. Other translations have of the sea. The travelers will travel east of the sea. The Amplified Version has on the east side of the sea. All right, so the direction is not clear. The next thing we need to look at is what sea is being talked about here. The Amplified says it's the Dead Sea. Jameson Fawcett Brown says there was a road to the east of the Dead Sea to travel south to Egypt, and that's true. Actually, I've been on that road. It's still there. It's paved now. But if you're going to get to Egypt, coming from north, coming from Jordan, that's the way you go. Of course, the sea could be the Mediterranean Sea, or the sea could be the Sea of Galilee. And one of my commentators says there was a route to the east of the Sea of Galilee that connected Syria and Babylon all the way down to Egypt. And that's true. I've seen the maps. There's a road there, a little dotted line. And of course, if it's the Sea of Galilee that's being referred to here, east of the Sea of Galilee is also east of the Mediterranean Sea, so it could be that. So there's a lot of ambiguity there, but the point is that there is a road going through a valley, and lots of people travel on it, and that road is going to be blocked up by dead people, Gog's soldiers. Now, remember, this is all metaphorical. There's not an actual valley that's going to be filled up with dead people. It's just referring to all of the Persians who got wiped out by the Jews in the times of Haman, 75,310 of them. That'll fill up a valley pretty good. Now, in verse 11, Gog is given a burial place in Israel, and people say, oh, critics of the Haman hypothesis say, oh, Gog is buried in Israel. Haman was buried in Susa, in Persia. This is talking about the people who were following Gog. It's not saying that literally Gog was buried, Haman was buried in Israel. It means all the followers of Gog. Now, this valley clogged up with corpses, will block the way of travelers. John Gill says, possibly through the smell of the corpses, which is pretty powerful, I'm assuming. It would be pretty awful. Or it could just be the dead bodies get in the way. That's a minor point. Now, let's get to the end of verse 11, and this really helps with the Haman hypothesis. Gog and all his hordes will be buried there in this valley, which is called Haman Gog. Let's take the word hordes first, or multitudes is another English translation. The Hebrew for that word hordes is hamono. I have the Hebrew here. The three Hebrew consonants in hamono, multitudes, are he, main, and nun. Those three consonants are the exact same only three consonants that are in Haman. Remember, the original Hebrew doesn't have the vowels. So hordes here is he, main, and nun, and Haman is he, main, and nun. Play on words there. And I assume Ezekiel was doing exactly that. So Gog and all his hordes, he, main, and nun, will be buried there. Now, where will they be buried? They will be buried in the valley of Haman Gog. Haman Gog. I'm anglicizing it there. Now, we've already seen that the Hebrew for multitudes that are buried is hamono, which is just a form of hamon, which is the first part of the name of the valley, hamon. So there's continuity between multitudes and the name of the valley where the multitudes are buried. There's also continuity between the Hebrew word for multitude, hamon, and Haman, Haman, same three Hebrew characters. He, main, and nun, same three Hebrew consonants. And if we've already seen that Gog is the same as Agog when we compare the translations of the Septuagint and the Hebrew in various places, I gave you an example. So we see that Hamon and Gog tied together is not much different than Haman and Gog being tied together. So Hamon Gog could be read as the valley of Haman, who was Gog. Let me read you from Dennis Harrelson. The resting place of the army that invaded Israel is called Hamon Gog. Ezekiel 39 even links this name Hamon, which is obviously quite similar to Haman, with Gog, which we know is synonymous with Agag. It is quite possible that Ezekiel 39:11 plainly says that the place was called the valley of Agag Haman. When we consider all these arguments, I believe we can conclude that Gog in Ezekiel 38 is a reference to Haman or Haman. And I think he's exactly right. Basically, the connection works like this. Gog is the same as Agag. Agag is the name of the king of the Amalekites. Haman is said in the book of Esther to be an Amalekite. So, Gog is linked to Haman. Haman is Gog. And then Haman is connected to the place where he's going to be buried, where Gog is going to be buried, in a valley of multitudes, which sounds exactly like Haman's name. And in fact, the name of the valley of Haman Gog is Hamon Gog, which is almost like Haman Agag. Well, I think that's a pretty strong argument for Haman, in my opinion. In fact, that's what convinced me. We go down to Ezekiel 39, verses 12 through 16. For 7 months, the house of Israel will be burying them in order to cleanse the land. All the people of the land will bury them. And the day I am glorified will be a memorable day for them, declares the Sovereign Lord. Men will be regularly employed to cleanse the land. Some will go throughout the land, and in addition to them, others will bury those that remain on the ground. At the end of the 7 months, they will begin their search. As they go through the land and one of them sees a human bone, he will set up a marker beside it until the gravediggers have buried it in the valley of Hamon Gog. There's our valley again. Also, a town called Hamona will be there. Well, there's that word again. Hamona, that's multitude. There's no such town as Hamona. That's referring to Haman again. And so they will cleanse the land. Now, I've already said earlier that the 7 years of burning the captured weapons of war of Gog was symbolic. Now we have 7 months of burying the dead bodies of Gog. That's symbolic too, in my humble opinion, in my very strong opinion. However, John Gill says it's literal. Now listen to how he tries to say this is literal. Actually, Adam Clark. Gill says it's literal, but so does Adam Clark. And this is what Clark says. Many of the Syrian soldiers. Now Clark holds to the view that Gog is Antiochus Epiphanes fighting for the Seleucids who were Syrians. Many of the Syrian soldiers had secreted themselves in different places during the pursuit after the battle, where they died of their wounds of hunger and of fatigue, so that they were not all found and buried till 7 months after the defeat of the Syrian army. 7 months was little time enough for all this work, and in that country putrescency, what a great word, and in that country putrescency does not easily take place. In other words, corpses don't rot very well. The scorching winds serving to desiccate the flesh and preserve it from decomposition. So that explains how the 7 months could be literal. No, folks, it's symbolic. Perfect, divine completion of destruction of the army of God. 7 is the number of divine perfection. Verse 13, all the people of the land will bury them. All the people, that would be non-military personnel, ordinary citizens, will assist in the burials. And the day I am glorified will be a memorable day. The day God is glorified is the day that Gog was defeated. Verse 14, men will be regularly employed. Now, that's not the best translation in my opinion. That's the NIV. Let me read you the Holman Christian Study Bible. They will appoint men on a full-time basis. That's what the NIV has as regularly. Men on a full-time basis to pass through the land and bury the invaders. All right, so there's a burial detail, lasts a long time, 7 years symbolically. They bury, and in addition to them, others will bury those that remain on the ground. So this burial detail will consist of people and burial details going around burying the corpses. It'll be a full-time job. There's so many corpses. And the NIV says others, besides the men who are employed full-time, others will bury. That word others is a translation issue because I've got about 4 different options as to what it means. Here's option number 1. The others who help in the burial of the corpses of Gog are passers-by who will assist those regularly employed for the work. The KJV actually has passengers, which is totally confusing. The Young's literal translation goes this way. It says the burial detail will pass on through the land, burying with those passing by. In other words, passers-by will help the regular detail. Option number 2, it's a search party. NKJV, New King James, I don't know what that means. Some translations just leave out the word others. Don't even have people helping the burial detail. The Revised Standard Version has this. They will set apart men to pass through the land continually and bury those remaining upon the face of the land. There's no others at all. Option number 4, the others don't refer to others helping the burial detail, but the others are other invaders who hadn't been buried yet. This is the Holman Christian Standard Bible. They will appoint men on a full-time basis to pass through the land and bury the invaders who remain. So the others is not the buriers, it's the buriees. J.P. Green's literal translation goes along with that, and they shall separate men who continually pass through the land, burying those who pass through, who remain on the face of the earth. Well, all of that is a lot of smoke about nothing. Who cares? The point is, there's going to be a lot of dead bodies. Now we have a problematic phrase here at the end of verse 14. At the end of the 7 months, they will begin their search. The they is either the burial detail or the others who are helping the burial detail. Why would they begin their search at the end of the 7 months? Well, they look around to see if the burial work was complete, as the Cambridge Commentary says, to see if any bones were overlooked. Let me read you from the Cambridge Commentary. When the remains that are visible shall all have been buried, men shall be appointed whose continual task it shall be to go through the land to search for any bones that may have been overlooked. When they find a bone, they shall set up a sign beside it that the buriers may come and inter it. That refers to verse 15, as they, the burial detail, go through the land, and one of them sees a human bone, he will set up a marker beside it. And so all the gravediggers have buried all the corpses of Gog in the valley of Hamon Gog. I've already talked about that. A town called Hamona will be there. That's figurative. There is no such town as Hamona. That town's name signifies a multitude. No city has ever had that name in Israel. And how do the futurists take that? They say, well, since there is no such town as Hamona, it must exist in the future in some restored time in the millennium. I've got a quote here from a futurist. Unfortunately, I lost who it was, but this is what he says. No city in the land of Israel has ever borne any such name. From whence it may be concluded that this prophecy does not refer to the times of Antiochus or any yet past, that would include Haman, but to time to come. And this is a typical futurist method of interpretation. If you can't explain it because there's a lack of historical evidence or a lack of theological acuity, if you can't explain it, then it had to happen in the future. And I think that leads to a lot of bad, bad eschatological views, in my humble opinion. Well, that's the dispensationalist futurist view that Hamona is a future city. Some people say that, no, it's a figurative name given to Jerusalem in particular. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that Jerusalem shall be famed as the conqueror of multitudes. I don't think so. I think the name is figurative of a city that has never existed in actuality. This was not a literal city. I even found a quote in dictionary.com, which is not exactly a theological source. Quote, multitude, of course, remember Hamona means multitude, a name figuratively, and I emphasize figuratively, a name figuratively assigned to the place in which the slaughter and burial of the forces of Gog were to take place, in Ezekiel 39, verse 16. Now here is a quote from Bible Guide in answers.com. The symbolic, and I emphasize symbolic, the symbolic name of a city in the valley of Hamon Gog, in whose vicinity Ezekiel prophesied that the armies of Gog and his allies would be defeated. A symbolic name. And again, let me repeat, it makes sense that the symbolic name would be a play on the name of Haman or Haman, because multitude is Hamono, has the three same consonants as Haman, Hay, Main, and Noon. We go now to Ezekiel 39, verses 17 through 24. Yahweh is now speaking to Ezekiel, not Gog. Son of man, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Call out to every kind of bird and all the wild animals. Assemble and come together from all around to the sacrifice I am preparing for you, the great sacrifice on the mountains of Israel. There you will eat flesh and drink blood. You will eat the flesh of mighty men and drink the blood of the princes of the earth as if they were rams and lambs, goats and bulls. All of them fattened animals from Bashan. At the sacrifice I am preparing for you, you will eat fat till you are glutted and drink blood till you are drunk. At my table you will eat your fill of horses and riders, mighty men and soldiers of every kind, declares the sovereign Lord. I will display my glory among the nations, and all the nations will see the punishment I inflict and the hand I lay upon them. From that day forward, the house of Israel will know that I am the Lord their God, and the nations will know that the people of Israel went into exile for their sin because they were unfaithful to me. So I hid my face from them and handed them over to their enemies, and they all fell by the sword. I dealt with them according to their uncleanness and their offenses, and I hid my face from them. So Ezekiel is charged by God to call out to the birds and the wild animals. This is the same invitation that's given at the Battle of Armageddon in Revelation 19:17, and I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid-heaven, come, assemble for the great supper of God. Now, I believe that's referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, because I have an Orthodox preterist interpretation of Revelation. But the point is, there's going to be a great feast, and the people who are going to be the meat for the meal are the bad guys. In the case of John in Revelation, the bad guys were the apostate Jews who murdered Jesus, and in the case of Ezekiel here, it's the Persians who were trying to murder the Jews at the behest of Haman. There's a little bit of difference. In Revelation, an angel cries out the invitation to the great supper, the great sacrifice. Here in Ezekiel 39, it's the prophet Ezekiel who calls out to come to the great supper. And in Revelation, only birds were invited to the beast. Here in Ezekiel, beasts of the fields were also invited. Minor details. And of course, the birds that are coming are not just your ordinary Tweety birds. Those are birds of prey carrion-eating birds, like turkey buzzards, vultures. Now, the beast and the birds are going to eat. They're going to have a big banquet, and they're going to be eating the people of Gog, the soldiers of Gog. And these soldiers are compared to rams and lambs, goats and bulls, fattened animals from Bashan, because Bashan was noted for its prosperity. It's right to the east of the Sea of Galilee. That's why Bashan is mentioned there. And verse 19, at this great supper, at this great sacrifice, the birds and the beast will eat fat till they are glutted and drink blood. Now, it's obviously the beast and the birds that are drinking the blood of the soldiers of Gog here. But listen to what the infidel Voltaire said. He said that this refers to the Jews. He knows enough of the Bible where he can read about this great supper in Ezekiel, and he says, oh, the Jews are drinking blood. He said that to vilify them, because drinking blood is barbaric, and it's especially unclean to Jews, as we know. Well, that's stupid. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about Voltaire. The assertion of Voltaire is either through brutish ignorance or satanic malice. I myself think it's the latter, because I don't think Voltaire was stupid enough to read that and think that Jews are drinking blood. It's very clear it's the birds and the beasts that are drinking the blood of the soldiers of Gog. Now, again, we might say, well, how does this refer to Haman? It's symbolic. And remember, the minions of Gog were killed to the number of 75,310, which included his own sons, by the way. 75,310, I think that fits pretty good, this sacrifice of soldiers of Gog here, soldiers of Haman. Now remember, Haman didn't actually have soldiers. Soldiers is just a metaphor standing for the citizens of Persia whom Haman weaponized to kill the Jews. Now God says this great defeat of Haman will display God's glory among the nations. In verse 23, now the nations will know the people of Israel went into exile for their sin. In other words, God is trying to protect his honor. People will say, ah, look at the Jews. Their God couldn't save them. Look at them. They're pitiful. Their city is burnt down. They got carted off into exile to Babylon. They're pitiful. People aren't going to say that after the episode with Haman. Oh, no. Because what happened was totally miraculous. And it amazes me when people say, well, you know, Esther doesn't mention God. Maybe it shouldn't be in the canon. Please. What happened to save God's people there, his elect nation of Israel, was incredible. And so verse 24 ends up this way. God is explaining to Ezekiel that from now on, people will know that God dealt with them according to their uncleanness and their offenses. That's why I hid my face from them, not because I'm weak. We go now to Ezekiel 39, verses 25 through 29, and we will be finished with this chapter. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. I will now bring Jacob back from captivity. Jacob, of course, is the people of Israel. I will now bring Jacob back from captivity and will have compassion on all the people of Israel. And I will be zealous for my holy name. They will forget their shame and all the unfaithfulness they showed toward me when they lived in safety in their land with no one to make them afraid. When I have brought them back from the nations and have gathered them from the countries of their enemies, I will show myself holy through them in the sight of many nations. Then they will know that I am the Lord their God, for though I sent them into exile among the nations, I will gather them to their own land, not leaving any behind. I will no longer hide my face from them, for I will pour out my spirit on the house of Israel, declares the Sovereign Lord. Now this is talking about a return to Israel, a return from captivity. I will now bring Jacob back from captivity. And it sounds like the return from Babylon. However, the problem with that is the return from Babylon was 538/537 BC, and the destruction of Haman, Gog, and all his forces is after that, after 538/537 BC. Haman is sometimes in the 470s or so. And so if that is the case, then Ezekiel 39, verses 25 through 29 is a flashback, if you will, back to the time previous to Haman, which doesn't really sound good. I guess you could say that Ezekiel, who was writing just after the fall of Jerusalem in 586, he was writing about 585 or 584, he was predicting the return after Cyrus. So after he relates Gog's future defeat, he then says, but there's also going to be a return under Cyrus previously. In other words, he takes it out of time order. But again, that's weak to me. It seems to me that what Ezekiel is saying here, and this is my view only, I have not gotten this from anybody else, and so take it with a grain of salt, To me, this sounds like the deliverance of the Jews after Haman was executed, to keep it in time order. And so the Jews who survived of the Haman will go back and rebuild Israel sooner or later as they go back to their homeland through the provinces of the Persian Empire, and they will help build Jerusalem, which of course happened all the way through the times of the Maccabees until the time of Jesus, when Jerusalem was a great city and Israel was a great country restored. To me, that's the simplest way of taking this. Now, whether it's referring to the return from Babylon or it's referring to a rebuilding of Jerusalem after the times of Haman, the deliverance could be a type of future conversions in the New Testament, which is mentioned by a lot of people, and I grant that. I think, in fact, that's what Ezekiel is talking about. Ultimately, all these deliverances of the Jews is to show that the Jews as God's elect are a type of God's elect in the church, the antitype. We've seen that type over and over again as we've gone through Isaiah, Jeremiah, and earlier chapters of Ezekiel. Now, Gill and Clark have the view that this return here in these last few verses of Ezekiel 39 refers to the conversion of Jews to Christ. Jews alone, I don't know why you just can't say spiritual Jews too, Gentiles as well. Adam Clark says this bringing back of captivity or from captivity of the Jews is the release of Jews that Antiochus Epiphanes had made slaves. That's again going on the view that Antiochus Epiphanes is Gog, which we've rejected. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this return of the Jews is a future restoration of Israel at the end of time, citing Romans 11:25, and of course that view assumes a final surge of Jewish conversions at the end of time, which in my humble opinion is a very problematic interpretation of Romans 11. So I'm going to leave this passage here, 25 through 29, this bringing Jacob back from captivity, as referring to the return of Jews after the defeat of Haman in the Persian Empire, the return of Jews to Jerusalem and Israel, and their rise under the Maccabeans, which is a type of the conversion of Jews in the New Testament church, both physical Jews and spiritual Jews, Gentiles. In verse 29, Yahweh says, I will pour out my spirit on the house of Israel. Now, that could mean he just will restore the house of Israel, but that sounds an awful lot like God pouring out the Holy Spirit on the new Israel, the church. And that is the way I take it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished our discussion of two of the most difficult chapters in Scripture, Ezekiel 38 and 39, the prophecy against Gog. I did it in 3 podcasts. I did the best I could. I could be wrong. But then so could all the other interpretations be wrong too, so I leave all of this to you for your consideration and study. Now we are prepared to go to Ezekiel 40, which I will call Ezekiel's vision of the new temple. I call it Ezekiel's temple. Now this is good stuff because it's going to be talking about the New Testament church very clearly. Hope you stay tuned with me for our discussion of Ezekiel 40, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion of chapter 39.